Hi, I'm Renee Champagne.
And I'm Rhonda Sestak.
Please join me and my sister as we discuss horrifying crimes, urban legends, and spooky locations throughout Oklahoma and beyond.
You are listening to Route 66 Fear Fix.
Welcome to Route 66 Fear Fix. I'm Renee.
And I'm Rhonda.
And I know we missed recording an episode last week, but I have been under the weather, and I don't know if you can hear it in my voice. I hope that I don't cough or do any disgusting noises. So because of that, we have Sean here today. Say hi, Sean.
Hi.
He's going to kind of background up a little bit, so if I go into a coughing fit, they can keep you all entertained while I'm dying in the background.
Maybe keep me on track and not lost in my notes.
Yeah. So, today we're going to do a true crime from Oklahoma. It's not a cold case. It's not something creepy. It's an actual true crime that occurred here in Oklahoma. It is the Edmond Postal Massacre. It occurred
August 20th, 1986. And it was at the post office. Where was the location of it?
The Edmond Post Office. I believe they have three now, but the one where it occurred is 200 North Broadway in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Right, and we took a little road trip out there to look at it.
Yeah.
It looks the same pretty much, except of course they've added the memorial and stuff for this, but we'll get into all that. But yeah, he, on August 20th, 1986, it was just a normal day for anybody at the post office going to work, about 100 people in the office at the time, when Patrick Sherrill, who was a relief carrier for the post office, and that just meant that he was required to work alternate routes on different days of the week. So he didn't really have a set route or even a set job. He was almost like a fill-in for different things. So when he walked in a little after 7 that morning, he shot 20 of his coworkers, of which 14 of them died.
And I have that he went in about 7 a.m., and then he came in there wearing his blue uniform, which is, that's just,
yeah.
It's creepy. That's why I'm around this word, creepy.
Yeah.
He went in there wearing his blue uniform. Maybe that was so, it looked like a normal day.
Right. You
know? And he had 3 pistols and ammunition in his mail bag.
Yeah. So just like he was going to work.
You know, except you also look at the background of this guy. I mean, they said that he was, you know, they called him crazy because he was always, you know, what? Hanging animals up.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Peeping in people's windows and stuff like that. So coming in with the uniform wouldn't be such an unusual idea for somebody like that.
Well, he was going to work.
Yeah.
In his mind, he was the normal one.
Yeah.
Maybe. Okay, let's get back to...
He probably did think that in his mind. Yeah.
So 2 of the pistols he had were semi-automatic. And you want to go on with the rest of...
Well, what I have, I mean, you know, they didn't get to talk to him. The police didn't, because all of this happened by the time the SWAT team had arrived, he had shot himself. So basically everything is speculation of what he was going in for. And it was said that he had been reprimanded. I don't know if it was the day before or week before or whatever.
I read that it was the day before.
It was the day before?
Yeah.
Okay, he had been reprimanded by 2 different supervisors, Richard Esser Jr. and Bill Bland. And they believe he specifically went in there to kill them.
Right, and he had targeted the, or he had been reprimanded because they were getting complaints from his routes of misdirected mail, and I guess he had a tardy problem. So even though being a part-time carrier...
Well, all that peeping Tom stuff at night makes you tired.
I guess, you know, even a part-time job, you couldn't get there on time.
Yeah.
That would be me, though. I totally can't be anywhere on time.
Well, I don't mean to laugh, because it's kind of weird.
No,
there's
no laughing now.
But when he went in there, I guess when he went in, he entered through the back door of the building. From what I understand. Is that what you found?
Yeah.
Okay. He entered through the back door. He first came across Richard Esser Jr., which is one of the supervisors that had reprimanded him. And he shot him and killed him. Mm-hmm. He supposedly was looking for Bill Bland, the other supervisor, but he had God on his side that day because Bill Bland overslept, and he was not even up there at the time. He had overslept.
I bet he felt, I mean, I'm sure he felt relieved, but I bet he felt really guilty.
Yeah,
for,
he had an angel watching him
definitely.
That day. But after that, it is said that he went in and just started shooting coworkers. And I don't think he had a grudge against any of those. I have not read anything that he might. But he just started shooting them. And, I mean, just think, there was about 100 people there. And most of them got out. I did not see out of which way he got out because wasn't, I believe I read somewhere he was going through locking the door behind him.
Oh, I didn't read that.
I believe I read that somewhere. No, well, I don't think he had any intention of getting out. I think he was planned on killing himself when he was there.
Yeah, you know, this is kind of like one of those sad stories when you look into it. I mean, this story depicts some lunatic coming in, you know, going crazy because he was mad at his supervisors and stuff. And then he got angry even more when he probably couldn't find the second supervisor. So he just started taking it out on everyone else.
But actually, when you
take some insight into this, this is a guy who was in the military. He was praised with the highest of honors. You know, and when he was released pretty much as a hero. And then he goes to a job where it doesn't seem like, to him, it maybe seemed like it doesn't matter as much. He doesn't matter as much because he's not that significant. Or now he's the insignificant one.
Which they said he, after the military, he never had a steady job. He was floating jobs, menial
jobs.
That's
what I was wondering.
And then with a job, you mess up on a mail or something like that. You know, then people complain. You know, then now in his mind, now you've got ungrateful people. You know, and his mind, he's still the hero, but at the same time, people are coming down on him. Everything's falling apart for him. He went from being a great success to being a failure. And that was probably something really hard to accept, is somebody with so much pride. And then, you know, the deal with the animals and stuff like that, you know, that was the venting of things to come. He had anger inside of him, at himself.
Right. Which let Rhonda talk a little bit about the animals and stuff.
When Sean is talking about the animals, when questioned about what his motives might be, the neighbors just referred to him as Crazy Pat. And he had some of these odd things. I'll let Sean finish talking about the animals after I explain that to you. In his neighborhood, he would go peering in people's windows at night. He just really did eccentric things, like a bicycle built for two. He would ride it as the only rider.
I told Ronnie to please not make me laugh during this
because
I don't want to talk, but
there was other things. He would tie up cats and dogs to his fence with baling wire and leave them there. And the kids in the neighborhood would try to rescue these animals. Sometimes they would succeed, but sometimes they would go in there and all they would find left at the animals were their paws and their tails, which is kind of gruesome.
This is crazy to me because in today's day and age, animal cruelty is, you know, you get punished worse for that.
It could carry a life without parole sentence.
Yeah. Right, but I guess back then were animal rights not?
I don't know if there were as.
I mean, that's 33 years ago.
They may not have been reported until the time of the incident, too.
Well,
you know?
I can't imagine they wouldn't be.
But did they not report him being a peeping Tom? I mean, surely you'd get arrested for that.
Well,
yeah,
people may have
marked
that off as just some crazy old man, you know.
But he wasn't an old guy. How old was he?
But
he was born in 41.
But
so.
I'm just saying they probably marked it off as him just being crazy because, like I said, they turned, you know, they gave him an actual name of, you know, Crazy Pat. Whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. They called him Crazy Pat.
Well, maybe it was like, remember our old neighbor Troy?
Yeah. You know, he was office rocker. He would come in writing chalk, "I love you," in front of our house, and he lived across the street, across the busy street.
I mean, we didn't call the police on that. So maybe it was maybe they thought
nobody called the police whenever he run up and down the road screaming and hollering and anything, you know, because they just marked it off as he was crazy.
Yeah. So maybe it's the same thing with this
guy.
But
the thing that gets me, though, is with the animal cruelty thing. You look back on some of the big cases and stuff of, let's say, kids more recently who have killed people and stuff like that. They go back and they look at it and stuff like that. And one of the things that starts off with it is
cruelty
with
animals.
Because that's what they're taking their anger out of, because the animal's not going to fight back. Most animals, if you offer them a hand of friendship, they'll come to you.
Yeah.
And they'll
true.
Accept
trusting.
You know? And
Yeah, because Jeffrey Dahmer, he tortured animals.
And the guy may have had enough sense to realize that, hey, I can't just go out killing people, you know, because of his military training. He knows that's not the right thing and stuff. So maybe he took it out on the animals. And then it got to the point where he snapped because he felt like his job was in danger, which was the only thing in his life that had any kind of definition of him being a decent person.
Right, because he, from what I understood, I mean, he lived with his mother till 1974 when she died, and basically he never had a actual relationship or friends. I mean, like a girlfriend or regular friends. He was kind of a loner, and that's how he was considered. So yeah, you're right. I mean, talking about like the neighbors and stuff, probably just, you know, didn't really pay attention to it, just thought he was an odd guy.
Yeah.
And I think that's what they thought up at his
work.
Yes,
and going back to the neighborhood
different.
We were just talking about, that Renee and I were just talking about, the name was Troy. We did the same thing. We marked it off as just, you know, a crazy guy and stuff like
that.
I mean, one time he asked if he could come break our yard with leaves and stuff like that, and he's out there just throwing the leaves up in there, having a good old time with it.
But maybe that's something
but,
we as a society
but,
need to pay more attention
yes,
to.
Yes, because a few weeks later, they had SWAT team over there having to get him out of his crawl space because he went down to the school down the road and told him he was going to go in there and kill everybody with a shotgun.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh,
so,
my goodness.
You know, now, whether he was being for real or not, the fact of the matter is that we have to pay attention to things like that because you don't know the stability of somebody's mind when they're doing that. If they're already unstable anyway, maybe they cross a line to a point at one time or another where there is no more right or wrong. It's only get rid of the problem or take away this pain.
Or, and it's just a different reality for them. They're not seeing the same reality that
they
we're seeing.
They may not view death in the same
permanence.
Infinite.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy has had the sense enough, the snap enough to be able to have specific targets in mind when he went inside this place. You know, he went in there specifically targeting the supervisors because they were the ones that reprimanded him.
Right.
You know, and from my experience and everything with a lot of supervisors and stuff like that, they have a tendency to belittle you whenever you're being reprimanded.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They make you feel stupid and inadequate because of the fact that the whatever you did, you should have known better. So you're being stupid by doing that wrong. And maybe that was the snapping point for him. And he's like, you know, if I'm so useless, why even bother anymore? You know what? I'm going to go in there and I'm going to take these two guys out and I'm going to take myself out. But he took one out, couldn't find the other, and just basically went to go on everybody that was in his way. Because now he's at a point in his mind.
He failed at even what he was trying to do.
Yes,
yeah,
it doesn't even matter anymore. Because now I'm a complete failure. I'm dead. I'm done for.
Yeah.
My life is gone anyway. I'm going to take my life. So what does it matter
who else I take with me?
Do you think that he intended to kill himself when he went in there?
I think he did because they said he locked the doors behind him. He had no intention of leaving.
Yeah, I feel like
he locked the doors behind him just to make sure he was. You know how when you're doing a checkpoint,
he was in front of those doors, so he knew nobody was going to get by him.
Oh,
you know.
I mean, that's one thing I would like to have looked up the exit points at this to see him locking it if he was corralling people. Or
his chances are most of these people that were killed on here were probably people trying to get by him to get out.
Well, they were hiding under tables and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, a bunch of them were in a break room, I think.
You know, and from my experience, you know, speaking, my dad was in Vietnam, and when we were growing up, there was a lot of instances where he would freak out. Sometimes he would literally take off into the woods and be gone for a while, and come back and be.
But this guy never went to war.
The thing is that when you're in a military training, they train you to not think. You are
not thinking for yourself.
The only thing you're doing is taking orders. And when it comes to a point to where you're no longer taking those orders, especially after X amount of years, what do? You don't know what to do. Because you're not used to making certain decisions in depth for yourself.
And then when his mom died in 1974, there was really literally no one left.
PTSD, that's one of the most common things with PTSD patients and stuff like that, is that the fact that they were not, quote, detoxed. They were not taught how to go back and live in the society
on their own in a society that's not structured.
I guess I never thought about it. Even if you don't go to war, you are living in a structured setting, and then you're
done. It's not going to prison where everything is done for you, basically. You know, and only thing you do is what you're told to do. Then after 15 years, they let you out. They say, okay, you go live in society. Okay, how do I do my laundry? How do I pay my bills? Where do I go buy groceries? How do I talk to people?
You're not in the military that long. You still have access to...
I'm just saying, you know, there's a lot of different factors there. And you said, one point you mentioned about him being with his mother, living with his mother for so long, being a loner. Most people who are like that, it's because something's not clicking right to begin with.
Yeah, because in high school he was described
because
as a shy
human
kid,
nature so. Is not to be alone. Human nature is that we want to have company. We want to be around other humans.
Normal human nature.
Right.
Yeah, but normal human nature can be defined in different ways according to how you see normality.
That's true.
So if this guy sees everybody else as being the weird ones, or maybe they don't accept him anyway because maybe he had some hard times at school. You know, if he was eccentric like that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they teach him about being a mama's boy or anything, you know, stuff like that. So he decided to, okay, you know what? I don't need people. He goes in the military, everything. He learns to do the one thing that he can defend himself the best with. He learns how to shoot and shoot good.
Yeah, because you said that
he was an expert marksman.
Yeah. Right. And you know what? Expert marksman in the military is like, basically you could put, and I've seen my dad actually demonstrate this, you could take a nail and put it on the edge of the roof, on the seal, everything, pace back 100 feet, then with your back to it, turn right around, aim, shoot, at that quick and hit that nail. And I've seen my dad demonstrate this, and he wasn't even considered an expert marksman.
I want to go back just a little bit, because I read that he had told the American, before this occurred, he had told the American Postal Workers Union that he was being mistreated. Do you think that they took any?
So that might have been.
They looked into it?
I'm going to say no, but that would have been something they should have, because that would have been him at least saying, hey, a cry for help in a way.
Right.
You know?
Because he was telling them that he needed to get out of there. And,
right.
You
know, but
and other people, and maybe at the workplace, may have been taunting him as well and stuff like that, you know, because if you're in that state of mind where your neighbors are calling you crazy and different stuff like that, I mean, surely it shows everywhere else too. And people see that. And unfortunately, in today's society, we are a very cruel society.
We are.
And we pick on the weak. We pick on those who cannot defend themselves. We are essential bullies is what we are. You know? And when somebody is not in the right mind, they may not say, hey, that offends me. They may even laugh with you.
Yeah.
But just because they're laughing at you, laughing with you, doesn't mean they're actually truly laughing.
I don't know.
You know? Because, I mean, I have a guy I work with who's not quite right in the head. And sometimes people talk about him and stuff like that, and he laughs and cuts up and stuff like that. But I can always tell when something's bothering him because it's the way his eyes look, even though he's laughing. You know?
Right.
And all.
That's a self-defense mechanism.
But it's not to the point to where they downgrade him or nothing like that. They just made little jibes or something like that. But then everybody kind of calms down. It's calmed down a lot over the last year and all. But, you know, people like that, they're not always going to tell you that bothers me. But when he said, hey, I'm being tormented or I'm being harassed here, and nobody listened to him, they either A, didn't take it seriously, B, brush it off. It's like, you know, you're not important enough for me to worry about that because you're already crazy.
But I don't know when he reported it. I don't know if they even had time to look into it. If he did it the day before, and then he's like, I'll just do it myself.
Handle it on my
own. I don't know.
You know, and you could have had very dominating, what I say by dominating supervisors, you could have had those kind of supervisors that look for the weak as a target to vent for themselves.
Yeah. I don't even know if it's that. I think that people, when they're appointed as supervisors, get that feeling of power.
They get power drunk. Yes.
And a lot of them take it to the extreme. And they have to remember, you know, that can have consequences.
I will say just something from personal experience. Is that when I was a supervisor one time, it is expected, at least in my job, of you to be a little harsh.
Well, you got to throw your weight around when you're a supervisor to let people know
that you're serious. That,
hey, yes, exactly. And I'm not going to put up with it. But you got to know when to tone that down enough to let your coworkers know, hey, I'm still part of the team.
Right.
Right. And I think that's where a lot of supervisors go wrong.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm not here to babysit you. I'm not here to belittle you. I'm not here to point out all your mistakes. I'm here to be the best assistant I can to help you get the job
to
done.
To be a leader. Yeah. To truly lead.
Exactly.
But I think there's such a disconnect this day and age between the workers and the supervisors. And it shouldn't be that way.
Well,
because I think that's where the
But you can't
start.
Be buddy-buddy
Well,
either.
It's like big brother and little sister. Okay? Big brother, adores little sister. Little sister adores big brother. But they're not going to go socialize into the same spots because they'll be in each other's way. You know?
This is true.
And it's not because the big brother doesn't love his little sister. It's because he wants to have that social life that means something to him, that defines who he is. And everything. And then the little sister, it's not that she don't love little brother, but what's big brother going to look like coming around all these little bitty kids and stuff like that and trying to have a good time?
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
But also, big brother usually will go to bat for little sister if anybody tries to mess with little
and
sister.
Supervisors will do
and
the,
that.
And
that is what a supervisor should
exactly.
do.
Exactly. A supervisor should defend you. They should uphold you. But they should also let you know, hey, you know, you could be better.
You messed up.
You could be better. It's not how you say it. It's not what you say. It's how you say it.
Yeah.
So I wonder if, being a good supervisor, if they called him in there and told him what he's doing wrong, did they offer him ways to improve? That's what they should have done. They should have offered him ways to improve, given him advice, asked him if he really still wanted to be there.
Well, judging by the reaction of things, he went after both of them.
Yeah.
Okay, so more than likely, he was probably reprimanded. He was probably reprimanded, and I'm just hypothetically speaking, right in front of everybody.
I don't know
it's about that.
It's a government entity.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's a government. It's a government entity with people who think they have the ultimate authority.
I don't know.
Oh, that would be something that would be interesting to know if he was reprimanded in front of
people. I've been in situations like that. Not that I've been reprimanded or anything out in front of everybody, but I've seen it happen. Not at the current job I'm at, but at other jobs that I've been to and everything. And a situation that, for those of us listening, didn't seem like it was that big of a deal. But to the person who was being reprimanded in front of everybody, now their pride got involved.
Yeah.
And it blew up into a whole big thing. And I've actually seen fights break out behind it. But I've also seen those same supervisors take other people into offices by themselves. And we know they're fixing to get into bad trouble because what they just done was one of the major no-nos. And they come back out 5 minutes later, they're laughing and cutting up with each other.
Yeah, because a good supervisor should be able to.
Yes.
And nobody knows what happened behind those doors. Nobody knows what was said behind those doors.
See, that's the problem these days, though, is that it goes behind closed doors and it seems like nobody else should know about it. And then that person, they just can't help but tell everybody else.
Right.
Now, the person who was reprimanded, I believe that they have the power to say so. Okay. What happened? Well, nothing. Or blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, it should never come from
now,
a supervisor.
Now, if the supervisor themselves goes telling everybody, that's where there's another issue happening.
Right.
You know, well, I actually had an incident like that happen, you know, and everything. And my supervisor come down and actually got onto them for it, you know, because that is not the way you conduct things. Because now you've taken something from an innocent, just, look, don't do this again. You know, I know you can do better. I'm going to help you get better, to bringing everybody else in and giving them ammunition, rocks to throw at you, so to speak.
Right.
You know, and if this guy already had a reputation, you know, of being crazy, you know, not quite right, you know, and all, he was an easy target for people.
Yeah, and it seemed like all was like,
you know, and it doesn't matter how weak you appear, doesn't matter how young or how old you are, there's only so much you're going to take before you snap. And when you snap, like Renee mentioned earlier, the reality becomes a different reality. Now the reality is not what we see. It's what the person sees. And all the person sees is enemy after enemy. What they said, what they done, what they said, what they done. Every person on the list that he killed, chances are, if you go back and look, and there's somebody somewhere along the way, they said something to him that he didn't strike a
chord. Oh no, I don't know if that's the case. I think it's more the theory, like you were saying, he didn't find the second supervisor, and he's just angry and calling everybody.
Or maybe in his mind, his version of reality at that point, everybody did say something. Everybody was the problem because he wasn't the problem.
Yeah. So, why do you think, did it say why he was only working part-time? I mean...
No, I didn't see where it was only, he was only working part-time. They just...
I don't know how much a part-time
said. He wasn't going. He wasn't seeing a doctor or anything like that, or a counselor or anything?
I don't know.
Not that I've found.
I just wonder how much a part-time postal job in 1986 would pay.
Well, when, I don't know if I said this already, they were, when they were trying to figure out a motive behind this, They listed the fact that he was a relief postal carrier, and the fact that he just got reprimanded is probably his main motives, because, I mean, obviously he killed himself. They didn't really get to talk to him.
Right, but I have that he only worked there 16 months. Well, I say only worked there 16 months. Working there for 16 months, you think... If he wanted to be in a full-time position, he could have been in one by that point.
Maybe he maybe he didn't want to, or maybe he wasn't... what they were looking for in a full-time employee. He was somebody that could give people relief when they wanted to go on vacation.
I don't know. It just seems odd to me that a 40-something-year-old guy wouldn't have a full-time job.
He did not have a track record his entire life of being able to hold down a job.
Oh, yeah, you said that.
So it was kind
of
like...
He might not have been capable of doing that. Maybe he's one of those people who's there 1 minute and then kind of wanders off, you know, and just does that. You have people do that. You know?
Do you get, like, preference points? Coming from the military, you do for federal jobs, don't you?
Probably.
So do you think he just got preference points and got hired in?
I
thought you got preference.
I mean, I don't believe, other than his neighbor saying about it, I don't see where he was in any prior trouble or anything like with the law.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, but this... Out of this thing, I had read when they were talking about this from a sociological standpoint, they said this particular incident at the post office awakened the United States to the reality that an upset employee, a disgruntled employee, any of that could one day walk in and point a gun at you. They coined the term lethal employee, referring to this, because... They had had mass shootings before. This is the first that brought it into the workplace. And sad to say, it was not the last. We've had a lot of them over the years. We've had more here in Oklahoma. You looked up
it. Well, the one that stands out to me is the Vaughn Foods, where the guy decapitated the lady. I mean, that's horrendous.
I mean, it's...
It's to the point, though, I have to say, we actually have... Which we have... training at work for if we have a, I don't even know what they call it now.
Active shooter.
That's
what they call it at schools.
Yeah. So we have training for what to do if that happens.
That's a sad state
in
our country.
But one thing I've also seen more and more of nowadays, and it is sad to say, but I'm seeing people, they go in and they commit these horrendous crimes, they kill people and stuff like that. Then they force the police to shoot them.
Yes, murder because by suicide by police officers.
They don't give the police a chance to be able to apprehend them. You know,
which angers me because I feel like so many people are committing these crimes and they're not being
because
accountable.
Because those are people who have already given up their own lives. But instead of taking their own lives, they let somebody else take it.
Right.
There was another one on I-35, like I was telling you, and I cannot remember. I remember the guy going in and holding people hostage. But, okay, so you want to talk a little bit about what we saw when we were out there?
Oh, yeah, we went out there to look, because they do have a memorial. I'll tell you a little bit about the memorial. It was erected on May 20, well, it was, what do they call it?
Ceremony?
I don't know. Whatever. On May 29th, 1989, they... cut the ribbon for this memorial. It's called the Yellow Ribbon Memorial. And it is a fountain. And in the center of that fountain is a man and a woman. And they're holding a ribbon that is attached. The ribbon goes to the bow, and the bow is attached to the bottom of the base of the fountain. And around the base, there are plaques for each of the names, which Sean will read here in a minute, because I want to remember people that were killed. But each of the names, and from those plaques, they have 14 water jets that form the fountain. It's a really nice little memorial there.
And I'll say I found that in 1996, the Smithsonian American Art Museum came and surveyed the memorial and said it was well-maintained. I would say that's not what we found.
I didn't see
There was no water flowing through it. I found that the fountain operation was halted in 2010 due to a damaged water supply line. That was 9 years ago. You'd think they could find a little bit of money, cash flow, to get that fixed to honor those people.
Yeah, come on, Edmund. Those people.
You guys have the money out there. Just
but yeah, it's sad. It just breaks my heart. I was in high school when this happened.
Yeah.
And I remember it. I don't remember being. I was a teenager. I was wrapped up in my own life, you know, like that. But I mean, I remember it being a huge thing at that time. I mean, because it was terrifying in Oklahoma.
I was a lot younger, so I honestly
it's kind of sad though, you know, about the memorial and stuff. Like she said, that like Renee said, that you know, for so long not having water just because of a faulty water pipe,
right?
You know, that's an easy fix.
These people deserve more than that.
And it's a simple fix at that, but you know, it's like as if, okay, now the pandemonium's died down, the spotlight's dimmed, so we just kind of push that back off into the shadows. But the fact of the matter is that that's a very important part of not only Oklahoma's history, but the United States history, because that is where the term going postal was coined from.
Yeah.
You know, people jive at each other now. They talk, well, you're going to go postal or something like that. But and the fact of the matter is that the term going postal was a very real thing.
Yeah.
You know, and it cost, you know, 13 innocent lives. 14 innocent lives. And lost the life of another man who probably could have been saved had somebody just listened.
But we still fight with this in today's society, 33 years later.
Yes.
And now we're not paying attention to mental
health. But now we're finding it nowadays, though, in our young ones.
I know, it's spilling into the schools.
Younger,
you know, younger and younger and younger and younger.
What's causing this, though?
And
I'm not sure. It has to be, I mean, we have talked, Renee and I have talked about our parents, their generation, and the generation before them. When I was growing up in the 70s, I can tell you that the parenting then is extremely different than the parenting today. I don't know because I'll tell you, if you had a mental problem back then, they would have just said, oh, get over it, go run a lap, get outside, get some fresh air, whatever, get over it.
So you come home and say somebody, so-and-so's calling me names or so-and-so like that,
right.
They would be like, well, don't associate with so-and-so.
Yeah, but nowadays we have even more mental health, and it's more rampant.
Well, I'm wondering if it's somewhere where a cross between babying too much the children and not toughening them up enough. If there's a thin line there that is being...
You have to teach your children...
They're not being taught about consequences of their actions.
Exactly.
Right.
You have to teach children the reality, the difference between reality and unreality. You have to teach them the difference between right and wrong.
Life is not a video game.
And you can't teach a child how to discipline themselves if you don't discipline them. Because then they know no discipline. All they know is reaction.
Well,
but I think we also shelter our children more. When we were younger, we didn't get kept home from funerals and stuff.
Oh,
Mom and Dad took us to funerals.
They took us everywhere.
We knew, we saw that person not moving, laying there. We knew that was a finality. And I think in this day and age, people shelter their children too much. They're like, they just went away for a while.
Exactly. They try to keep them away. They try to keep them away from reality.
Right.
And then when reality finally hits them, it's a shock to them.
Yeah.
Right. Because it starts with the pet.
Yeah. You
because
can't just say, we sent them away. You've got to let them learn about the natural things in life.
It happens.
And the finality of
the hardest thing one of the hardest things I have ever had to do with my kids, there was two incidences. One was when my grandfather passed away. And I had to explain to them what happened.
Right.
The other was when we had a dog that died and everything, and they didn't get to see him be put down. I did, but they knew, and I told them and stuff. And it was hard, very hard to do, but at the same time, I need them to understand that part of life is not just living, but you will die one day. You know?
I mean,
and so with that realization, hopefully that'll make them want to be able to make the best of life that they have while right. they have it.
Right. And it makes them hopefully not preserve life, but
value
life. Yes, thank you.
And lost not my only value their own lives, but value the lives of others.
Right. Exactly. You know, to know that there is a price.
Nowadays, society is so selfish.
Yeah.
It's all about me. My rights.
Right.
You know, and they don't care about anybody else's or anything like that, as long as they get their way. That is a spoiled child.
Right.
Unfortunately, the adults are the ones that are spoiled, because they're the ones that are spoiling the children. And which, in the long run, it leads up to things like this, because they don't see the signs, not because the signs aren't there, because they don't want to see them. Nobody wants to see an imperfection in their child.
Yeah, makes me wonder
nobody
if
wants to admit their child needs help.
Had ever thought there's just something wrong with him. Or something, or if she, I hadn't read anything in depth.
Or
on what
maybe she thought he was in the military. They probably would have caught something. You can't tell me he was in the military and they never noticed something wasn't quite right in there.
It makes me wonder why he never saw battle, never left the United States. But he was honorably discharged, so it wasn't because
when was
they thought.
Late 60s, 70s. He could have been one of the ones that were like maybe on the verge of autism.
Do we know what his rank
the perfection
was?
Of something. You can perfect something that no one else can perfect, but other things, simple things, might be really hard for you.
You said he had moved on to the reserves or something like that.
Yeah,
I mean,
he's in
the
National
last,
Guard.
They're the last ones to go, right? They usually, well, they.
Yeah, he was
deal
in the Marines.
In the country.
I don't know if when he came out of the Marines, if he went to National Guard right away, which I assume you probably would have kind of a transitional thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know how the military works in that instance, but I mean, he stayed within that. I don't think he was out of it. I don't think he left the National Guard.
Well, once you're in the reserves, you're in the reserves pretty much forever.
Okay.
Then you, and like when they said, you are the last one that they will be able to call out to the line of
battle.
Because
you stay here for
yes.
the country.
They may call you if they have a
flooding
issue or something like that. You know, one of these natural disasters or something
right.
that happens around and
but
they need help.
It makes me think, I mean, I keep going back to he never left the United States. He was a Marine when he went. Marines are usually the first ones in, are they not?
Yeah, because they're usually one of the highest trained. I mean, the Navy SEALs, most of the Navy SEALs actually come from the Marines, and all, and most of your special forces are derived from or comprised from the Marines.
I wonder if there was something there that he never left the United States.
I feel like we're putting so much focus on him, we should at least read the names.
Oh, yes.
We should read the names of the
victims. The names of the victims I have here are Patricia Ann Chambers, 41 years old, part-time clerk. Judy Stevens Denny, 41, part-time clerk. Richard C. Esser, Jr., 38, was the supervisor. And Patricia A. Gabbard, 47, was a clerk. Jonna Gregert Hamilton was 30, a clerk. Patty Jean Husband, 48, a supervisor. Betty Ann Jared, 34, clerk. William F. Miller, 30, the rule carrier. Kenneth W. Morey, 49, was also a rule carrier. Leroy Oren Phillips, 42, rule carrier. Jerry Ralph Pyle, 51, rule carrier. Paul Michael Rockney, 33, a letter carrier. And Thomas Wade Shade Jr., 31, part-time clerk.
And Patty Lou Welch, 27, a clerk. I wanted to say that Mike Rockney was also, I read that he was the grandson of Notre Dame football coach Newt Rockney. So, I don't know, that was just interesting. But I mean, it's sad, and just reading those names, come on, they deserve better for that memorial. I realize it's 33 years ago. I get it.
Yeah.
But come on, it's
a
nice memorial.
They deserve to be remembered.
Yeah.
Well, you know.
I mean, they are remembered, but
we put so much effort into you know, preserving and remembering the 9/11 victims. You know,
well, that's
that,
a country.
Exactly.
This is a city level.
Affected a whole, but in essence, this right here is also.
This did affect the
and
country.
It should,
at the time,
I think it deserves the same kind of recognition and all because of the fact that at this point now, this is the first of its kind. You know, and it was like you said, it was an eye opener. It was something that made people start realizing and looking deeper into the work area and the condition of the employees mentally.
They haven't
not
done
just
a good
physically.
Job of it, though.
I don't feel like
you know.
I don't think they know what to do.
Well, it's same with the schools. I mean, I don't want to keep getting on the schools, but this all falls under the same umbrella here
because it's a mental instability that makes
right.
you think this is okay. Because
yeah.
I'm sorry, I've been angry numerous times at every single supervisor I've ever had.
Yeah.
Would I go in and shoot them?
No.
Am I angry? So angry? Yes, I get so angry.
But you know how
I
to
understand
handle
the repercussions if I were to do that. So what is the misfiring?
And another thing,
and how
too,
do you identify that early enough?
Another thing too, I believe that society has also closed the door for people to be able to bring up things like that. And what I say, what I mean by that is, when I was growing up, if there was a kid or an adult even that just didn't seem right, I could go to my mother and father and say, "Hey, look, you know what, Dad, this guy's acting all weird, you know, and everything like that." And if my dad knew them, he would tell me about it, or he would look at himself and he would say, "Okay, well, maybe they just, you know, can't think the way we do," or whatever. You know, he would explain it to me in a way that I knew. Nowadays, kid comes up and says, "Hey, this person over here is acting crazy. Don't say that. That's not nice to say that about people."
That's
okay,
true.
Well,
that's true.
And now we've just completely ignored what they just told us. They give us a warning sign about that person.
That's true.
Well, we just completely ignored that because we were focused on
what people would think of us saying something.
Yes,
about
or
someone
whether or not we
right.
would offend somebody by bringing it to the light.
Yes.
And so now we kept that in the dark. Well, then that same person that they pointed out goes down the road years later, nothing like that. This is hypothetically speaking. You hear about them on the news. They went into a mall, semi-automatic with a shotgun and two semi-automatic rifles and everything like that, and decides to level 100 people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nobody knows why. Nobody knows why there was never even warning signs. What about that kid that told you? That you said, "Hey, that's
yeah,
not nice."
Yeah, but
don't
also
say that.
I also think the other part of that is,
you know,
people don't want to say, "Hey, I personally noticed that I'm not thinking right. I've got these issues." Because what's going to happen? Are you going to get a job? No, you're going to go see mental health counseling and all this stuff.
As soon as
but
you're
labeled.
People don't want to hire somebody like that.
But a lot of people who have those problems don't realize they have those problems.
Some people do, though.
Yeah, some people do.
Right.
And all. But on the flip side of that coin, we don't want to alienate them and say, "Hey, everybody that has a mental problem is a bad person," because that's not true at all.
That's what they say.
That's not true because...
But that's society does differently.
It's like the guy, you know, bringing up another state, just like the guy in Vegas that shot all those people at the concert. You know, it was perfectly normal. No, he wasn't. Or he wouldn't have done that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's...
Somewhere along the line... There's a snapping point, you know.
Yeah,
that's the point that we haven't figured out yet. That's the point that nobody's figured out yet. You know, where does that snapping point at? You know, where does it begin?
It's not even about that. Is
you know,
it's the early signs. We need to identify them
point.
Before that.
Yes,
right.
You know.
Because once you're to that point, it doesn't matter
you know,
what it is.
And we need to,
causes.
You know, and one of the problems that presents itself is how to deal with these without making people feel uncomfortable. How to deal with it without making the person in question feel like that they are not accepted or not wanted. You know, it's really hard. It's a really fragile line, really fragile thing to deal with, you know, but at the same time, it's something that needs to be dealt with.
I agree. It needs to be dealt with. But honestly, society talks all this about, "Oh, we need to help these people, blah, blah, blah." But at the same time, society's like, "I don't really want you around
right.
for me to help." So it's kind of, it's never going to get dealt with if there isn't somebody that champions for that,
right,
for those people. And the hard thing is, because these people have not had prior law troubles or anything like that,
those things get pushed to the back.
You won't find them unless there's somebody willing.
And nowadays, it's harder. It's getting harder and harder and harder to find people that could deal with that stuff in depthly because, well, basically, they don't have the means and the money to be able to do that
anymore.
Right,
our cities and stuff like that.
And because the government has taken it away from them now, says we're not going to support that stuff anymore.
Right.
So it's like, where do they get these funds from? Because it's not cheap. It's not cheap to have somebody, to be able to hire somebody with enough training and enough discipline to be able to sit and listen to these people and be able to see what needs to be seen and hear what needs to be heard and know how to deal with it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know.
So do we have anything else to say about the postal massacre?
No, I think we got off topic, but it's a lot of
stuff. I did
want to
say, since the postal massacre in Edmond, there have been 7 postal shootings in the United States. So,
yeah.
In my opinion,
this is a sad story, not just for the victims, but also for the guy who went in and did the shooting and stuff as well. I don't know, I feel like it's a big failure on the part of society in general. But it's not saying it's going to cure anything, because it doesn't, obviously. But had we been addressing these issues beforehand, I felt like it maybe might have been avoided.
Yeah. So in general, let's do better as a society. And Edmund, please step up and get some water flowing through that fountain. It's a really pretty memorial, and it deserves a little
bit
better.
And it's in a really pretty part of your town.
Yeah. Downtown Edmund is cute. It's really cute. So, all right. Well, I think that's all we have for this episode. You are listening to Route 66 Fear Fix.